Now we'll get back.
This is KAZU FM in Pacific Grove. It's Mae Bressel, and we'll begin side two of this broadcast. It's number 613, September 5th, 1983. Before I go more on Larry McDonald and that airplane that went over Moscow and went down, well, we assume it did. They still haven't found the parts. There was a party in Vail, Colorado that reminded me of a party at the home of Clint Murchison the night before John Kennedy was killed. This party took place, it was described in the New York Times, August the 29th, 1983. It took place in Vail, Colorado. There was a conference of world leaders, and the party was hosted by Gerald and Betty Ford. Pictures of them dancing in the New York Times. Attending this little cozy dinner was Helmut Schmidt of West Germany and Gerald Ford, United States, and Gaston d'Estaing of France. These are all deposed monarchs. James Callaghan, Callaghan, formerly the Prime Minister of Great Britain, and Prime Minister formerly Malcolm Fraser, Fraser, of Australia. What did they have in common, this little group? They described themselves on the front page of the New York Times as, "What we have here is a beautiful experience, a conspiracy of former world leaders against present world leaders." And then they said, "Thank God none of us has the power to alter anything anymore." And then along with the party is a picture of Henry Kissinger, always in the operation. What do they have in common? Covering up or contributing to the concealment of the assassins of John Kennedy. Of course, Gerald Ford was on the Warren Commission. Helmut Schmidt was in Germany with the Reinhardt-Gehlen operation. Gaston d'Estaing worked with the Permandex, the group that had tried to kill Charles de Gaulle. Mr. Callaghan in London has Samuel Cummings of the CIA arming Frank Turpel and George Corkula and the terrorists all over the world, Mr. Carlos, Mitchell Ward Bell. All these people are involved, such as the Nugenhan Bank. Mr. Fraser was put out just recently. Oh, that's another country that went socialist, is Australia, and they're investigating the Nugenhan Bank. All of these people, Helmut Schmidt, Gerald Ford, Gaston d'Estaing, and James Callaghan, and Malcolm Fraser, are part of the narcotics traffic, the Henry Kissinger group, the Western Goals that Larry McDonald was part of, the links to the military, the drug traffic, the Vatican connections, the Masonic Lodge, Licio Gelli. I'm using a lot of names that some of you may not be familiar with if you don't listen every week. But they had a little party in Vail, Colorado on August the 29th, and a man they worked with and closely with, Larry McDonald, went down 2 days later. And a lot that Larry would be subpoenaed to talk about, or if he would be exposed to through courts if he ever lived long enough, could go on up to them. So his death is similar to George de Morenschild at the time of the House Select Committee on Assassinations, or William Sullivan of Division 5 of the FBI, or John Roselli, or Sam Giacano, or Carlos Prio Siqueiros, when the House Select, or Gary Powers of U-2 flight, when the House Select Committee on Assassinations was investigating who killed John Kennedy. There were about 20 murders within that summer and fall that just followed one after the other of primary witnesses, so that the committee never really rubbed up to those people who had a part in the assassination. They stayed a safe distance away. And also, when you wipe out these people, the next person isn't quick to testify. Now, if this was a provocation, as I say, you'd tamper with the instruments, and there was evidence that they could not change or were not aware of what they were doing, and the instruments were simply taking them in. And also, they said, as I said before, that pilots could be asleep. I doubt they were asleep if they said, "We're going up to 35,000, because they didn't say anything else. There's no record of what they said, and it's all still wide open. The Kremlin, according to newspapers in, this is the Monterey Herald and LA Times, remains unapologetic. They are holding on to their story, and what they said is, "Does Mr. President," that's Ronald Reagan, "believe that the very concept of national sovereignty no longer exists, and one may intrude with impunity into the airspace of independent states? Or is he viewing the whole world now as a zone of U.S. vital interest?" And as I've said before, I didn't see him crying elephant tears about Jonestown with 900 American citizens. We were talking about that earlier on the talk show before this came out. He simply didn't care. The Soviet Union said he's crying elephant tears now but he's missing the point. And they asked questions in the San Francisco Chronicle last Saturday, why the American authorities resort to all kinds of dirty insinuations about the USSR, but they did not try to establish contact with their airplanes or warn them or tell them to get back on the course. They asked that question. They're attacking the Soviet side as a deliberate violation of what they should be doing. The Soviets were protecting their territory. They said one's attention is drawn to the fact that already in the first reports, reference is made to the Central Intelligence Agency, and further reports have increasingly grounds to consider that this flight was not accidental. It was indicative of the post-factum that the American only wants to hear one side and that they want to continue this breaking up of Entente and Cold War. And the Soviet Union was quite aware of the techniques that the newspaper and the media have been pushing around. Ernest Lefevre, L-E-F-E-V-E-R, you may know the name, had an article in the newspaper, an editorial September the 2nd. That is quite soon after Larry McDonald died and the plane went down. And he has a story, the Soviets are brutal, but we must negotiate. And in this, just a two-column story, he says they're brutal. They are brutal. They are run by scuff law regime. They can't be constrained by normal behavior. They have a long record of official Soviet repression. And it goes into the fact they're not ordinary people, that they dominate the world. They don't work on principles or objectives that we have. And he goes into Yellow Rain and Poland and Afghanistan. He doesn't talk about Chile and Argentina and El Salvador or Brazil or Bolivia or Uruguay or Paraguay. They have their usual shtick. Well, Lefevre is a part of the office of General Graham of High Frontier, a formerly Defense Intelligence Agency, who shares the offices in Washington, D.C. with Hitler's, Fritz Kramer's mentor, Fritz Kramer. Graham lectures, I had on the broadcast a few weeks ago, with John Reese. They were recently in Colorado. Reese is of Western Goals with Larry McDonald. So you get an editorial of a man who, if you don't know Lefevre, you think he's just righteously indignant. But all of a sudden, he's in the offices with General Graham, Daniel Graham of the Defense Intelligence Agency, and John Reese, and Louise Reese, who his wife, who works for Larry McDonald. So you're not getting an objective editorial. You're getting a story that had to be written that was hot off the air with all the details. Now, if you want to go back to May 1983, I did broadcast 599, broadcast 600 and 601 on Larry McDonald, of his links to Western Goals, J. Peter Grace, and Zyklon B. and Auschwitz, the Otto Ambrose connections, the list of Larry McDonald to Strom Thurmond and the Vatican and the Reinhard Galen operation, and to the Munich massacre in Germany in the Olympic Games, and the George Habash of Beirut, Lebanon, and Fuad Habash, his brother, in Santiago, Chile, and Dr. Anthony Malik, M-A-L-E-K, of the CIA in Chile and Lebanon and Atlanta, Georgia, and Larry McDonald with gold smuggling and robberies and heroin and cocaine and art galleries, and how Robert Byron Watson told the House Select Committee on Assassination that this gang was the syndicate, was Murder Incorporated, and so forth. Now, the minute Larry McDonald begins to be subpoenaed for the LAPD, he's silenced. His plane is down. Now, the Birchers have a lot of stories this week. Birchers believe the Soviets downed the plane to kill the group's leader. They don't believe that Dorothy Hunt's plane crash went down to protect Richard Nixon. Anti-communist, the likely target. McDonald, the vocal foe of communism. The Birch Society calls it murder. McDonald's family and friends are outraged. The victims of the ill-fated plane. The ultimate irony ends McDonald's career. Of course it's irony. He should be killed at the hands of the communists so that they continue his legacy. Representative Larry McDonald, staunch foe of the Reds. He kept the dream of the House on American Activities and listing people who haven't committed crimes into computers. That was his dream, and that's what he was doing, and he was doing with people like the Pentagon and the Crime Syndicate and the Roy Cohns. And if I repeat those names, don't forget it. Now, August the 1st, there's an article in the L.A. Times and San Jose Mercury on how the state spied on political groups. August the 18th, the Los Angeles Herald says showdown on the police department. That's the public Disorder Intelligence Division, PDID, showdown on the documents they've been subpoenaed. On August the 18th, the Washington Post finally had a front-page story, anti-left group probed in L.A. secret files, August the 18th. And I took note of that because by August 23rd, the police files were going to have to be turned over to the Civil Liberties Union. By August the 25th, 430 documents linked to Larry McDonald and Western Goals and computers that went back and forth going way back to 10 years ago when they were supposed to be destroyed and were illegally kept, put into his computers. The Washington Post gave him a front-page story on the 18th, and he was dead on the 31st. It's by Michael Martinez, anti-left group probed in L.A. secret files case in Alexandria, Virginia. The Los Angeles grand jury issued a subpoena to the executive director of Western Goals, a private foundation formed in 1979 by Representative Larry McDonald, with plans to develop a computer file on those who seek to bring revolutionary change in America. If you want abortion, you're revolutionary. If you don't like napalm in Vietnam, you're revolutionary. If you don't like people being beheaded and cut open in El Salvador, he considers you a revolutionary. If you don't like certain actors or movies, or if you read certain books, or if you review books in the newspaper, or you produce certain plays, you get into a computer. If you have certain jobs, Larry McDonald turned them over to corporations. Do you want to hire these kind of people? John Reese, who works for him, will sell a profile of you to any corporation in the United States. If you think the blacklisting is over, forget it. It's been going on, and a lot of good people still can't get jobs. They can't get cut records. They can't get contracts. For whether it's opera or light opera or singing or writing books or book publishers, he will sell to them everything about you that he thinks he doesn't like because he interprets it. And don't forget, as I said, on the board of Western Goals is Admiral Moore, a sleazy guy that was stealing from the President of the United States, as if Reagan is so great society. I mean, they steal from each other, but they get, if you read about Admiral Moore in the new Seymour Hersh book, you get a little bio of him on Western Goals. And as I mentioned before, when we were talking about this, Edward Teller, he invents a hydrogen bomb, and if you protest against it, Larry McDonald puts into a computer because you're supposed to like his hydrogen bomb. So Western Goals was asked after it was revealed that they had these files to turn over to the ACLU and the police department information. They want to know what kind of information was fed to Western Goals. See, it went to a police detective, Jay Paul, that I did those broadcasts on before, who's married to Mary Love, and she's a lawyer down Long Beach. And he would take cartons of data banks from the police department and petitions and so forth, and then put them into data banks and send them back to Larry McDonald. Then they go to 50 states around the country with the Pentagon. See, the Pentagon's not supposed to keep these lists. And they admitted they're judges and actors, and John Reese was taking over the carpet in New York, and they've secreted these things. Now, the LA Times reported, this was last week, this was in August 19th, the Washington Post was saying, the LA Times asked that Jay Paul turn over all the computer floppy disks, the printouts, the storage tapes, which the foundation, Western Goals, had been receiving from Jay Paul. Now, you get those, and you get a different picture of Larry McDonald and who is in and recorded on those tapes, and then you can sue under Freedom of Information Act. And there, once the story broke, where these things had been for 10 years, people were looking for them, and they were in the hands of the computers of Larry McDonald. It wasn't long before McDonald was made a martyr and sent off to the next world. Communist, left-wing organizations, and they were asked to turn these over. This story has been brewing in Los Angeles. I take the Los Angeles Herald Examiner. I take the Los Angeles Times. There's no one around the country who subscribes to these broadcasts who has any information about John Reese, Western Goals, or Larry McDonald. And they get it through these broadcasts, and I copy articles for them. But finally, the Washington Post did have a story about the lawsuit. There was a story, PDID, that's the department. The detective is distrusted. Another story, the LA Times, August 25th, after the front page story on the 18th of Western Goals, and it refers to the right-wing Western Goals Foundation and how they supply an organization called Research West, formed by FBI officials, and they compile information on anti-nuclear activists and turn it over to the energy corporations. I'll put all of those articles in order, and particularly the ones that are mentioning Larry McDonald and the 180 boxes of intelligence material that was taken to the home of J. Paul to put into Western Goals. There's a story in the L.A. Herald, August 28th. This was 3 days before the plane went down. About 180 boxes of intelligence material, some of it allegedly ordered destroyed by the police commission in the mid-70s, has been recovered from the data banks of Western Goals, and they've hired lawyers for J. Paul. Now, this John Reese and Daniel Graham that work with Western Goals and Admiral Moore have a reputation with gathering material on anybody they don't like and putting it all into computers and data banks, and they are a very dangerous group. As a matter of fact, I got a clipping from In These Times, August the 26th, just this last week, Spies versus Spy, and he said when Ronald Reagan wants to bait the nuclear freeze movement, he cites Reader's Digest and their expose of the Soviet manipulation and infiltration of these groups. And he quoted in one of his speeches John Reese, and it goes on to say that in the article in the Village Voice in New York, they said that John Reese was exposed as an infiltrating informant on the left. He never belonged to the left. He published Information Digest, and he's been a paid informer for the government and a snitch, and that he works in the offices of Birch Society Chief Representative Larry McDonald. So the Village Voice is writing about Reese and McDonald, the L.A. Times, the L.A. Herald, and the name is not publicly and not many states associated, but it's very important. A lot of stories, I have maybe 200 articles on Chief of Police Gates and Larry McDonald, and one of the splinter payoffs of this McDonald death is probably that it'll reduce the tension at the Olympic Games, because he was planning a lot of violence, I believe, and was part of the Squad 19, the LAPD, and the files, and maybe with a connecting links to the military and the police department tied up in lawsuits, it may prevent some of the Reichstag anger whipped up if there's terrorists at the Olympic Games. If you see Ronald Reagan handling the news and the press, the way they are doing this Russian story on the airline, you can see what they would do if they picked up a terrorist in Los Angeles. Well, just quickly, what are some of the indications that this plane is sabotaged? I'll run down a few quotations from articles this week that I've been cross-filing. As I say, 007 is licensed to kill, and no explanation of why no voice coming out from the airplane or not receiving messages. Chung Byung-in, C-H-U-N-G-B-Y-U-N-G-I-N, of the Korean Airlines, was the pilot for the president of Korea when he came to the United States. He's a very strong man. He was in the Japanese Korean Air Force. He's Korean intelligence and very influential, powerful man to go down with the plane. But if he got orders to keep going straight, he went straight. The London Observer said has a story also this week about a flyer who disappeared with a strange parallel, and often in the news, like that book, Black Abductor, as a reminder of that today that came out before Patty Hearst was kidnapped. The London Observer, August the 28th, just 4 days before this plane went down, has a story called Spy Plane Mystery Deepens. And it's about a book just coming out now, The Flyer Who Disappeared. And it's a Swedish fellow whose father disappeared. And it's described as one of the most embarrassing, highly charged mysteries of post-war history, how this Air Force captain went out, left home, went into the Soviet Union. He had a Swedish military plane, a DC-3, and he listened to Russian naval exercises, just as this Korean Air Force pilot could be watching Russian exercises or picking up pictures. The plane was used for spying, just as this plane was used for spying at high altitude. And the Soviet Union, when they find the parts of that plane, you'll find spy equipment similar to Gary Powers in the U-2. The crew of that plane never returned in 1952, and right now it's 5 days that they haven't admitted or at least found the bodies of those people. There were no distress calls on record. It simply disappeared, and there were no distress calls here. The plane simply accordingly went down, but this is just 5 days and very unusual, no report of it. The incident caused a major disruption between Swedish and Soviet relations and almost forced Sweden into the NATO membership. And this is causing major disruptions between the Soviet Union and the United States and Korea and Japan and the outrage Ronald Reagan wants to get will whip you up to a lather. This book tells about how Sweden was not in NATO, so they would send spy planes over to Russia and then turn the information to NATO because NATO wasn't supposed to be doing this and Sweden wasn't supposed to be in NATO. The crew allegedly was kept captive, and this fellow thinks that his father was alive or was seen there. But it was covered up, and it was a provocation that broke off Sweden with Soviet Union and pushed them to the side of the Western world because the Soviets were so terrible. And actually, the plane was a spy plane, and it wasn't supposed to be, but it severed the feelings of people towards the Soviet Union. Now, the United States has been spying on the Soviet Union since World War II, our ally. The New York Times has a story of the strategic bases there, how we deliberately planned flights there to get Soviet response in the 1950s. This is the New York Times, September the 2nd, that we have deliberately planned flights to get a response, that we know the Soviets have orders to shoot down the aircraft. And even though they're approved in Moscow, we have deliberately provoked them. The Soviet Union said they ignored 9 earlier provocations of this type that they knew were going over them. The San Francisco Chronicle had an editorial, September the 3rd, unanswered question, how was the aircraft equipped with sophisticated electronic navigational systems straying into Soviet airspace? A retired U.S. Air Force Major General George Keegan, also with the Fritz Kramer, Henry Kissinger Foundation, their group, says we don't know and never will know who gave the orders, but the Seattle Times had a story. If we monitor Soviet aircraft speaking to Soviet ground command centers, why couldn't we listen to the United States, not the United States, the Korean pilots or the United States intelligence telling them they were off course? That was a question from the Seattle newspaper, September the 2nd. An American manned radar facility is stationed in Japan and, according to the Seattle paper, probably tracked the airline to its destruction. Well, why didn't it warn it? If a American air manned radar facility tracked the airliner to its destruction, which is a quotation from the newspaper, the Seattle newspaper, September the 2nd, then the question is, why didn't they warn it? This Seattle paper said, nothing flies over or near Sakhalin, S-A-K-H-A-L-I-N, that we, the United States Air Force, don't monitor. This is a quotation from the Pentagon. There's eavesdropping by the United States and the Japanese, and also the military radio transmission listeners are graduates of the language school at Monterey, California, and also San Angelo, Texas. The San Francisco Examiner, September the 4th, said there are substantial odds against human error or equipment malfunctioning considering a 2.5-hour diversion from normal flight path that led to the airline flight 007 being more than 300 miles off its course. The substantial odds against this human error ever happening. This was the San Francisco Examiner. The New York Times, September the 2nd, said the pilot was in constant communication with his ground control describing the sequence of the movements. The American officials didn't have real-time information, that their information is put into some computer and retrieved months or days later. Do you believe that there's no communication between Japan, Korea, United States, and planes going off their course, that this is all academic and they pull it out of some box later, but only the Russians know that we're inside their territory? The LA Times, September the 2nd, says the Japanese military said that the Korean pilot may have erred on their location. The pilot had a mistaken latitude and a longitude. In the final 17 minutes of the plane, the digits in the latitude and longitude were different and opposite to the locations that they had tracked. The pilot told Tokyo he was 147 degrees longitude and he was 141. And he said he was 41 degrees north latitude, and he was 47. So the 147 and 141 and 41 and 47 were completely off. And the LA Times said the radar pinpointed them flying at 141 and 47 degrees north, and there was a switch in the digits given by the pilots that was completely off. Why did it go off its course? The LA Times, September the 2nd, said the experts can't figure why it stayed so far from its planned course. There are five air lanes from Anchorage to Tokyo, and it's 38 miles away from Soviet airspace. The Korean jet is equipped with three separate units, and this is important. They're modern computerized flight control systems that are in use at all times, and they are set. The jumbo airplane is set automatically, and the crew makes periodic inputs of flight plan into the computer. If the plane flew off its course, 400 miles off the course, where was it supposed to be flying, and how could they get there if they had three ways to check? Another story in the Los Angeles Times, September the 2nd, the Japanese defense can monitor the voice of the Soviet pilot, and the United States monitors heard the radio transmission as they talk, but again, they don't hear the other two-way. It's not a two-way. Isn't that interesting that the one up above flying, you can monitor what they say to each other, but you can't monitor anybody in the plane in control of all those people in that plane. The New York Times, September the 3rd, said the National Security Agency has a worldwide network of electronic eavesdropping stations, and it is clear that the route flown by the airliner was off its course for a sustained period of time. There was one article I read that it was off for 7 hours. There was a question of where it was for 7.5 hours in Canada, up in British Columbia, the Globe and Mail. I picked up the newspapers because I was up in Vancouver this week. It said the plane last heard the pilot report his position up 35,000. I mentioned that before. And the pilot gave no indication of any trouble at all. Not at all. And the weather was good. The radar was only 180 kilometers north of Hokkaido, H-O-K-K-A-I-D-O. And actually, it was 560 kilometers as against 180. Their last response, when they vanished off the radar screen, they were going up to 35,000, and they were not heard for 7.5 hours. Now, that's something we're not getting in the American newspapers. 7.5 hours they weren't heard, and they were followed for 2.5 hours. That's a long time, and the National Security Agency, according to the New York Times, tracks these airliners and watches what they're doing. The New York Times, September the 3rd, said the National Security Agency, one of the pilots said, "We know it was a premeditated act, a deliberate act, and yet they haven't accounted for the way the equipment didn't work, the direction, the height, the longitude, and so forth was off, and there was no response to any signals. They didn't react to signals. They didn't react to warning. They went higher up to where the Japanese say there are spy planes, and the Koreans say, and the CIA admit there are spy planes." Another story in the LA Times said that in order to get a deliberate act of aggression like this, you'd have to have your story ready to collect the information of what happened to have it pat. Well, certainly the president and members of Congress and the news media, the columnists, the Birch Society have had their story so pat that by September the 2nd, there were at least 100 articles on this damning situation. Not 100 articles asking questions, just 100 conclusions, articles over and over again with the worst words of the bestiality, the terrible character, the character assassination. You can't trust them. They're brutal and so forth. Well, I'll do some more on the Kennedy assassination next week, and then I'm going to get back to Larry McDonald and his organization and his role with terrorism and the Los Angeles Police Department. But that's all we have time for this evening. This is Mae Bressel, and it's KAZU in Pacific Grove, California. Now, interestingly enough, we don't have a disc jockey in tonight. You know, it's Labor Day, and he isn't here, so I may put on some music for you. Diane, find some music for me. Hi, my daughter's here, and she likes music, and until we get the blues, we usually get the blues on KAZU. We'll turn on some music. Let's see what mood Diane's in. I'll be disc jockey tonight and give you a little bit of music. How would that be to follow World Watchers? Because the people that listen to this program for an hour and a half are going to rest. Okay, let's get a nice... What's your choice tonight? Elvis Costello, Little Triggers. She likes Little Triggers? Okay, Elvis Costello, you're coming on. And Mae Bressel is going on right now. We'll put on Elvis Costello.